Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the Deals podcast, where we sit down with private equity and venture capital practitioners and talk about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Sathiraju, consumer and retail reporter for The Deal. We have with us today Jared Stein, co-founder and partner at Monogram Capital Partners, a Los Angeles-based consumer-focused private equity firm that has invested in brands such as Oatly, Chewy.com, Diggin Restaurants, and Foxtrot. He's here to talk to us about the firm, its investment strategies, portfolio companies, and much more. Jared, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. So tell us about your path to launching Monogram. What went into that decision?
Yeah, absolutely. I had spent my career prior to Monogram in large cap consumer-oriented private equity. So first at Bain Capital and then two spin-outs of Bain Capital, most recently Golden Gate Capital. And going back to 2013, really started a look at the consumer landscape and started to see some pretty fundamental shifts that were fostering the next rise of great brands from the emerging brand side. And so my career prior, you know, I had been spending time with brands like a Domino's or Burger King that were leading their respective consumer categories. And there were a couple sort of underlying shifts in the ecosystem that started to foster a significant share shift to these, what we would call disruptor brands. And so that combined with a passion to move a bit earlier stage to work with founders as they realize their vision, and generally to maybe move a little bit more into the sphere of health and wellness, no disrespect to the Domino's and Burger Kings of the world, led to wanting to form the firm back in 2014.
And how has the firm expanded since then?
It's been a gradual process, as you'd imagine. So we started really with a core epicenter around food and beverage and high growth brands that were going to be the next category leaders in their respective verticals. And where we've continued to evolve the strategy really has been around becoming an ecosystem investor. And what I mean by that is there are often subsegment trends where through the branded lens, we get to see what's going downstream in supply chain dynamics within a given space. And that often leads to investments that are more on the manufacturing side, for example, that can be then critical enablers for those emerging brands to rise and get to scale. And so oftentimes, one of the things we've seen is there are brands that are in a space that's growing really fundamentally strongly, but at the same time, it's hard to delineate between the various brands going after that space. And so there's often a second derivative opportunity where you say, all right, we'd love to be tethered to the underlying growth tailwinds for this category, but not in a way where we have to pick a single winner. And so having that more brand agnostic way to play spaces has been a really helpful other modality of our investment strategy. And it's an area that now is extended into the tech-enabled solutions that also foster those brand success as well.
And off the top of your head, how many companies would you say you've invested in so far?
We've invested in over 30 brands now. And in a lot of cases, it's been a really exciting journey in the sense that we've started with these brands as they're early on, still professionalizing as the first institutional capital into them, and then followed on many times over as they've proven out the underlying thesis that we came in on and really accelerated their progression. And so that's been a fun journey, especially as you look at companies that were pre-IPO like a Chewy.com or an Oatly, and then went into the public markets and only continued their outperformance.
So the firm has a very varied portfolio when it comes to your investments within consumer and retail. And I'm curious to know, outside of food and beverage, what other subsectors you've invested in or you would continue to focus on as you go forward?
Yeah, not surprisingly, what you'd find is that a lot of the underlying tailwinds that are driving food and beverage adoption and the shifts of the modern consumer in the category are also affecting other subsegments. So in particular, pet and beauty and personal care are levered to a lot of the same underlying trends that we see in food and beverage. So whether that's personalization, a shift toward health and wellness, cleaner ingredient decks, all of those are pervasive trends affecting both those categories, where there's about a 5 to 7 year delay, actually, in terms of product innovation relative to food and beverage. So it gives you a nice predictable pattern of where the world is going to move. So those have become two core verticals of ours as well. And then I'd add to that health and wellness as a general bucket. So that can be fitness. It can be looking in the supplement vertical as well. And those will all continue to be core parts of our investment strategy.
And I imagine plant-based food too, because Oatly and then Koya are investments of yours.
Yes, very much so. We've seen a significant acceleration of the penetration of plant-based foods, driven, in fact, in large part because of a flexitarian movement. So what you've seen is there's always been a certain segment of the population, which is a relatively small minority, that are vegetarian or vegan. But even the mainstream consumer has started to reduce their usage of traditional meat-based items. And some of that is environmental, as you might expect. And there's been a real nice increase in salience on a lot of those fronts and that issue through the pandemic. But some of that is also just a preference and a perception around improved health from a more plant-based diet. And there's been a lot, whether it's the Michael Pollans of the world or, you know, other outspoken advocates of a plant-based diet, the Tom Brady's, if you will. I think the average consumer has just become much more aware of alternatives. And at the same time, the last piece of it is food has to taste good. And so I think the acceleration of technology meeting the consumer's taste buds where they're at, you know, you've been able to find alternatives that actually taste just as good and in some cases better than their traditional meat alternatives.
Absolutely. And all this makes me wonder about your origination process and how you go about researching these different subsectors and trends and land on something that you think is an absolute must from an investment perspective. So I'm curious to know what that process is like.
Yes, we tend to be very thesis-driven, as you might expect from the Bain Capital sort of lineage that's been beaten into me over the years. So we focus a lot on where the consumer trends are moving. And we start oftentimes from a top-down and a bottoms-up perspective. So top-down, looking at retailer scanner data, what are the areas that we're seeing the consumer really accelerate their adoption and where are we in that penetration curve? So we use a metric called ACV, for example, that'll give you a proxy for how widely distributed a certain set of brands are or a category is relative to household penetration. And that's the top-down view. And then we'll look bottoms up and say, what are the brands that are sub 100 million, but growing at over 50% a year and really taking share from the alternatives in their space? And that starts to give us a really unique market map of where we may want to try and build a partnership dialogue. I'd add to that the interesting overlay, and it goes back to our strategy, which I do think is differentiated, particularly at this end of the market, which is we're also very well plugged into the supply chain side of those dynamics. So when we're talking to the brands, we're also understanding where they manufacture. We're hearing a lot of anecdotes around line time and how hard or easy it is to come by, what the margin structure and the ass of those co-packers are as that ebbs up and down. And so that allows us to formulate a certain thesis. I'll give you an example, which is through Oatly and Koya, which I know we were just chatting about, we saw that the line time for what's called aseptic beverage, which is the manufacturing process that all plant-based beverages go through, was really scarce. So scarce, in fact, that most brands were being forced to sign up to 5 to 10 year type agreements. And so that was the light bulb that went off and said, from a co-packer perspective, let alone a branded perspective where we have great connectivity in the space, we should be looking to stand up a platform, which we did last year in this vertical, because the supply demand imbalance and the underlying drivers of that demand are only accelerating. And so that's, you know, oftentimes we're marrying the brand view and what's going on there and share shifts with the underlying supply chain view and how easy or difficult it is to come by supply and then determining where we want to play within a given market map.
That is quite interesting. And can you tell us more about this platform that you invested in last year, the co-packer that you mentioned?
Part of our model, and it goes back to this founder-led view, which is find great folks who have incredible domain expertise and then figure out creative ways to work together. And so in this case, we had looked at a number of assets that were in the space, and it's really a relatively consolidated manufacturing base that's available for the segment of aseptic that we were most focused on, which is called low acid aseptic. And so we spent quite a bit of time really just looking for management teams that we could work with, and ultimately spun out a management team from one of the largest players in the space and stood up a platform around them. And so a lot of that was about 6 months of going back and forth and thesis formulation to say, what are the most interesting aspects of this space? Who are the brands that in an ideal world, clean sheet of paper, we'd want to work with, and why? And how do we set up a new platform that's really clustered around those areas that we think are going to foster the next wave of growth? And so it took us about a year and a half in total, but ultimately one of our largest investments in our most recent fund. And it's because of the extremely high degree of conviction and frankly, contract visibility that we're able to sign up, even, you know, upon inception with launching the platform.
That is definitely interesting. And you kind of answered my next question a little bit, which was the characteristics that are really important to you when you're looking at these consumer and retail companies. Obviously, founder-led, strong management teams, those fall into that. But I wonder what else you're looking for, particularly in terms of things like maybe financial metrics and R&D, things like that.
The table stakes for us in this consumer landscape that has become only increasingly louder and more competitive is just, does a brand have a reason to exist? Are they a true first mover? And does the consumer really care and have a longevity to that focus on that given vertical or that given brand in particular? And oftentimes that orients back to, what is the founder narrative? What is the mission and the ethos of that brand? And how much does the consumer identify with the brand above and beyond a transaction or a consumable purchase occasion? And so we start everything from that vantage point, which is, what's the brand's reason to exist? And then we start getting into top line growth, margin structure. We're huge believers, as you might expect, just coming out of the large cap view of the world, which is unit economics have to be fundamentally sustainable. We've seen so many dollars go into the high growth consumer space in brands and businesses and spaces where the underlying unit economics don't have a line of sight to cross over. And we can talk about some examples of that. But for us, that is a guardrail that we just never will really violate, no matter how attractive the top line growth for these brands are. And so to put some numbers around this, typically we'll start tracking brands as they're at least approaching a $10 million run rate revenue marker. And then a number of our brands will actually initiate a partnership as they're approaching or exceeding $100 million of revenue. And so a lot of that is a view on relative market share and where they are in their life cycle arc. So something like a Chewy.com, the business was larger than where we would normally enter, but it was also a category killing brand that was early in the penetration curve of the shift online for pet and had some of the best cohort economics I've ever seen. So when we started the dialogue with them, we noticed the company was almost 50% on auto ship and 87% of revenue was recurring in nature. And so the paybacks of those customers, not to mention the evangelism around their customer service model, was just enormous. And the penetration of e-com and pet at the time was around 6%. And you fast forward to today, it's almost a fourth of all consumption behavior. So a lot of it is in the life cycle. How well positioned is that brand? And what can we, Monogram, be helpful in accelerating that progression?
That's great. And you obviously mentioned that, you know, you've seen a lot of consumer dollars flow into these sectors or maybe companies that you're not sure could hold up from a fundamentals perspective. I'm curious to know what those sectors may be and if you are seeing more investor hesitancy in investing in those kinds of companies and what trends from last year are really going to hold up going forward.
Yeah, it's a great question. We have looked time and time again at the meal kit space as a really great example here, where there is a consumer need that's underlying why there's been a rise in popularity of at-home consumption, particularly for simplifying the dinner experience for families that have dual income parents and are only increasingly getting busier. So you start from the nucleus and there's a fundamental reason why companies have succeeded and dollars have been attracted into the space. I think when you start to peel back the layers and look at the underlying unit economics for a lot of those businesses, though, it becomes really challenging to fulfill on a 1 to 2 day shipping type basis for a consumer that wants a lot of variety and wants to also layer in out of home experience into that. And therefore, what we would call box fatigue happens more often than not. And that starts to affect payback. So you've had rising customer acquisition costs, especially with the shift toward iOS 14, that sort of increased all of those CACs for everyone. And then you have a retention rate that, when you look at retention rates after 12 months, we've seen a lot of those meal kit delivery businesses have mid to high single digit retention rates, which just make it that much harder because you're sort of on the treadmill of having to reacquire that new customer. And the LTV, the long-term value of that customer as a result, doesn't always pay back for what it costs to onboard them. So that's been one area. And I'd say a lot of those same headwinds are actually universalizable to what's happening right now, or the rise in the last 2 years of the quick delivery businesses. And so that was one of the underlying trends we were watching. And it's actually a reason, which we can talk about, where we look to play more of an omni-channel view of that space. So it wasn't just a DTC experience for the consumer across that individual channel, but you could actually increase both the TAM and the long-term value of that customer by servicing them in an omni-channel fashion that included retail as well.
And I do want to talk about that, particularly from the perspective of Foxtrot and your investment in it. You were one of the two lead investors in their Series B, their $42 million Series B. So I would want to hear more about what went into that process, as well as why you decided that they were a better bet.
Yeah, absolutely. The convenience channel is one that I've watched for a long time because it fits all the characteristics of what we look for in a potential space that has yet to see a lot of the same disruption, where there are analogs across all other segments of grocery toward a shift toward better for you, and in general, just more curation toward a modern consumer. And so that market is roughly $300 billion in annual sales. When we started to look at it back during our initial investment in Foxtrot, only 2% of those sales were occurring online. So you had a merchandising challenge that the traditional alternatives weren't servicing a modern customer, and you had a delivery challenge in terms of the mechanism of which you were serving that same customer. And so Foxtrot was really unique and a first mover in the space to both entirely up-level that merchandising strategy and incorporate better-for-you brands, incorporate local finds and a discovery aspect to their curation, but then marry that with an omni-channel view that enabled the consumer to shop them in-store with in-store pickup, which can be extremely convenient. You've seen the rise of that with the Targets and Walmarts of the world, and then service to their door generally within an hour. And so all of that created this really strong value proposition to the consumer. And it was manifested in the fact that when you dig into their consumer behavior, you see that 12-month retention statistic that I was talking about previously. On a dollars basis, their average customer that was shopping them across channels was producing over 100% of their initial revenue 12 months later. And so those are the signs to us that you've got a business that is really over-delivering and going to take share in a space, because that customer loyalty and frequency of purchase ultimately will drive the revenue and the flow through to margin that'll foster the next wave of growth in the business.
And since we are talking about the companies that you've invested in, I would like to talk a little bit about Olipop, which was your most recent deal, a $30 million deal that you led. And I'm curious to know about that as well, when conversations started with them originally, and what led to your decision to put more money behind them, and what's next for the company really with your support?
Yeah, one of the secular trends that we've seen really accelerate over the last 3 years has been the shift toward lower sugar diets. And that's really across food and beverage. And so when we started looking at that, in some ways, the most obvious space that had yet to be disrupted was the soda category, which is almost a $30 billion category in the US. And you look at the top 10 brands in that space, and 9 of 10 of them were actually declining year on year. And that was because their velocity on shelf, or the number of units that they sell per store per week, was decelerating pretty significantly. as even a core consumer said, instead of drinking three Cokes a day, you know, I'll do the right thing and I'll dial that back to one. And so with that, we started to see Olipop really originate an entirely new space, which was not only a free from or sort of reduced sugar profile for soda, but that maintained that traditional flavor, that nostalgia that everyone grew up with and still craves, especially if you're talking about me and root beer. But they also delivered with that a functionality that no one had ever brought to the category. And by that, I mean, their positioning really centered around a science-led focus on gut health and the microbiome. And so they do that through a higher fiber content. They do that through prebiotics and just a whole lot of work, even from the foundational days with third-party institutions like Baylor University around the efficacy of that product and the impact it'll have. And so for us, that was just a really exciting confluence of trends and a space where there was clearly one player that was first mover and outkicking the balance of their competition.
And what is the company going to be doing next from an expansion or growth plans perspective? If you can share any details around that, and how would you be involved in that process as an investor?
So with this last raise that we completed a couple months ago, the company brought on about $30 million of cash onto the balance sheet. And in large part, that's because line of sight heading into this year, they already knew they were over doubling their door count, in addition to driving really significant sales online of e-commerce. And you want to talk about one of those great leading indicators of the fact that a brand matters to a consumer. Go on to social media and look at Olipop's level of engagement, the number of comments that you see from their customers. But the fact that you've got a significant percentage of their customer base that is on subscription, buying $40 boxes of soda with multiple units, because that's become their daily habitual behavior. And so another great proxy for just how much the consumer is passionate about the brand. So you combine both of those channels of growth, and the business is well over doubling this year and starting to approach that $100 million revenue mark by year end. And so that was the piece that got us really excited. Alongside that, in terms of our role with them, we've been focused on, as is often the case with our brands, building that supporting layer underneath our founders who are fantastic there, but giving them domain experts that they can really rely on across channels, across functions, and then also really trying to leverage our retailer relationships. In a lot of cases, not necessarily Olipop specific, but we will bring retailers onto the cap table with us in exchange for guaranteed distribution and real support shoulder to shoulder with these brands. We'll give them a small performance-based equity stake in the business. And that type of alignment means you've got a real retailer partner across the country that you can really scale with and then use as a case study for other businesses. And so that's been a focal area of ours. And then I'd say the last piece is really just understanding the underlying manufacturing model. It's again, part of the benefit of operating on both the branded and the manufacturing side and over-indexing toward brands that are either self-manufacturers or are in spaces where we've owned a co-packer and we know what that pricing structure should look like. And so working with the founders to find an optimal manufacturing partner and really optimize gross margins, because every dollar that brand can capture can get reinvested in the top of the funnel activity that drives that outperformance in sales.
And there's another company, actually a couple of other companies that I do want to talk about as well. One is Genexa. They are quite interesting to me as well, particularly what I've heard about them in terms of the clean label ingredients for these traditional OTC products that we use all the time. Curious to know more about that company as well.
Yeah, Genexa is one that's near and dear to my heart. You know, it was an investment we made last year and a space we had followed for a long time, not dissimilar to the Foxtrot prelude, in the sense that the global OTC market is over $150 billion. And the brands that we all know and love and grew up taking when we weren't feeling well, like a Tylenol or an Imodium, when you start to dig in and really parse the ingredient deck, oftentimes there's really only one active ingredient in them, but because of the extended shelf life and a lot of the FDA requirements that are in place in that segment, you've got to have another 15 to 20 artificial additives and other stabilizers that are in there. And so Genhexa was started by two dads, if you can believe it, that really cracked the case on being the first clean to market OTC brand out there. And they've gone segment by segment, starting in kids. And later this year, spoiler alert, they're going to launch adult SKUs that go head to head with the Tylenols, the Peptos, and other segments of the space. And they're really paving a path toward clean. You know, everything they use outside of the active ingredients is sort of a real food type ingredient that you would recognize and that doesn't come with the dyes and the fillers that can cause reactions in a lot of consumers. And so we're tremendously excited about where this business is going.
That's great. And I would be remiss not to ask about Oatly as well, which went on to become a big public brand now. I remember you telling me that you came into the process, you came into investing Oatly much later than you usually do. I'm curious to know what that was like and what part you played or how you were involved from that investment stage to them going public, getting that investment from Blackstone.
Yeah, Oatly was what I would say was a five-year courtship, if you will. So there are certain brands that just are always on the radar that you kind of love the way that they're showing up to a market, both in terms of timing and getting there first, but also in terms of the way that they're building their tribe of customers and what they stand for to their loyal customers. And Oatly was one of those that was just a fantastic example of really building that rapport and that advocacy. And the best indicator of that is always that velocity metric I mentioned in terms of the units per store per week that they would sell relative to any other plant-based alternative. The other overlay that we saw was if you looked outside the US, oat milk, which had had a longer penetration curve in Europe in particular, was the dominant form of plant-based milk. In the US, that penetration curve was much earlier on and nascent. And so you could see the analog of where oat was going to continue to take share from almond and soy. Soy had really already started to fall out of favor. And with almond, obviously, there's water implications from an ESG perspective. There's allergen implications. And I know a lot of my favorite coffee shops started to only standardize around oat. And so that all predated our involvement and really our love of the brand. Since we've gotten involved, the business has done a phenomenal job of broadening and extending their line in a really thoughtful way. So whether it's oat-based ice creams or yogurt, they've extended that usage occasion in terms of product, but also in terms of channel. So they've partnered, as an example, with a lot of stadiums around the country now. So Wrigley Field in Chicago, you can go and get an Oatly soft serve directly in that machine. So we think the way that they've grown their market and increased the basket of Oatly goods that the consumer can buy has been a really nice methodical progression that led to them going public and an infamous Super Bowl commercial and a lot of continued growth ahead when you look at a brand of that scale that's still growing over 50% per year.
The other interesting thing to me is restaurants, which have had their share of troubles and also a very hot M&A market last year, completely opposite. But I'm curious to know what your take is on the industry and how you look at investing in that space, what kind of perhaps prerequisites you have when you're going in there, especially from the perspective of dig in.
The restaurant space has always been tough categories, as you mentioned. And so for us, I'd say the bar is admittedly particularly high in restaurants. And part of that, just operationally, when you think about it, the skill set that it requires for a GM in a restaurant to both deliver culinarily, but also manage that to a P&L, it's really hard to find those folks, let alone scale them over time. And so we're always a bit reticent, especially when you see concepts that have had early success, of how that will scale and be replicable as they move into new markets and expand outside of their original territory. So that's one litmus test that we always apply when we look at restaurants. I think the other is just not unlike other segments, but probably even more so, restaurants, the sea of options for consumers is just so competitive these days. And that includes, obviously, especially on the back of the pandemic, at-home alternatives as well, and delivery options. And so all of that would say, we're looking for real consumer behavioral indicators that say that a restaurant is well positioned to continue to grow and outpace its competition, that oftentimes the best proxy for that is frequency of visit. So you can look at a concept like Chipotle, who's considered best in class in that realm, and the average customer is going roughly 3 times a month to Chipotle. And so that tends to be our barometer of, we want to see new concepts that are actually outpacing Chipotle, because if the consumer continues to go back, it says there's a breadth of the menu, there's a consistency of that service and that culinary experience, all of which is pretty differentiated and drives repeat purchase. So those are some of the table stakes of how we think about finding really best in class concepts. For Dig-In specifically, we saw that frequency was north of 4 times a month. So incredibly high frequency in the most competitive market, arguably, which was New York City, where they started. And they had replicated that success in Boston and now in DC as well. So that was one of the validation points that we got excited about. I'd say combined with that, they were one of the early movers in farm to table, healthier eating option that also had an accessible premium pricing model that was still approachable to the mainstream. And then the last piece of it was really seeing that there was a cohort of offerings that came out in this healthier, better for you space that were all oriented largely around salad and cold items. And Dig-In, and in part just due to the operational complexity of doing this, had really had this interesting unlock to supplement salads with a lot of hot items that enabled the consumer to eat there more frequently with a lot more variety. And so that was another factor that we looked at and said, this is a business where these unit volumes that they're doing, which are in the top decile of other fast casual concepts, are going to be replicable and they will scale to multiple markets across the nation.
The other bit that I missed out on asking you earlier is fitness, which is also a pretty important track that you invest in. And you also invested in a franchisee of Planet Fitness. And I'm curious to know how you view that industry at home versus going to the gym with everything that's been happening in recent weeks. What do you think of that space?
Fitness has been fascinating from my perspective, watching it through the pandemic over the last 2 years. So as you said, we made an investment in 2017 in one of the largest Planet Fitness franchisees in the system. At the time, they actually only had 14 units. And then over the last handful of years, we've scaled that to about 60 units across multiple geographies. So it's been a really great growth story. And last year, we brought a partner into that business that will now help us drive the next wave of growth there. But one of the things you saw within Planet Fitness was, even through stay-at-home orders, especially in California and New York on the coast, the concept did incredibly well. So while there was inevitably a dip in visitation rights, the membership itself only declined, you know, mid-single digits, even peak to trough. And then the resiliency of the model and the loyalty as people wanted to get back into the gym and have that community-based experience meant that we're already back north of pre-COVID peak levels of membership across our clubs, which is just staggering to think about that degree of loyalty. When you think about that with the interplay of at-home fitness, one of the consumer surveys that we ran with our partners there during the early onset of the pandemic was understanding how that shift was transpiring, especially as every headline in the fitness space highlighted the Pelotons of the world and the shift to at home. And what was really comforting to us and became a key strategic pillar of how we managed the business through that 2 year period was the fact that over 50% of our core consumer base had at least one piece of fitness equipment at home. And so looking at that, it said the new world for fitness is a hybrid environment where people want the convenience of using their at-home equipment 2-3 times a week, in most cases, to be honest, when you look empirically, but then supplementing that with the ability to go to a gym, to have a more social occasion, and also incorporate multiple modalities of their fitness regime that you can only really get in a gym footprint as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned co-packing earlier, and that got me thinking about private label as well and how that has been doing as an industry, particularly with so many retailers with beauty products, personal care, just sort of bringing in their own brands that in some cases are doing better than the traditional brands. So what has that been like?
it's definitely been a major driver in the market, particularly as you saw through the pandemic, consumers be a little bit more value conscious. So you saw a shift even from natural grocery chains to conventional grocery chains, and then from some of the branded options within a given set to private label options. Now that is very category specific. So there are certain categories that you'll just never see private label have real credibility in the minds of that consumer. But there are a number of more commoditized areas where you've seen private label gain real share, and they can deliver a product at a price value equation that's extremely compelling to that consumer. Within beauty, I think it's a really interesting space where maybe 10 years ago, you would have said, doubtful that retailers will be able to crack this and figure it out. It's been so brand centric. I think that's certainly still true for a broad swath of beauty. But there are areas, again, more on that baseline or basic offering, where not only are retailers starting to make some inroads, but they've actually been a little bit more crafty in the way that they position their control brands, and they distance them from the banner of the retailer in a way that consumers at least associate it with a standalone challenger brand. And so I think that's one trend that we're always cognizant of anytime we enter a new category, which is what is the state of play with private label? What's also the price structure? How much room is there? What's the margin structure? Because oftentimes you can see if there is a significant amount of arbitrage between brand and private label in terms of that pricing or margin structure, there's room then for private label to undercut the brands in that space. And you've got to be mindful of those category trends as well.
And looking forward, I'm curious to know what subsectors within consumer and retail you think are going to have the strongest tailwinds, even beyond the pandemic, whenever that is.
Yeah. You know, I think from a sector perspective, our strategy will continue to focus around the segments we've talked about. But to your point, there are always share shifts within each of them. And so if you take food and beverage as an example, one area that we got really excited about through the pandemic that we felt would have a pervasive shift in the way consumers were interacting with the brands that they were selecting was really around immunity-based products. And so we made an investment in Vive Organic that was the leader in immunity-based shots, and that segment is now expanding with a through line all based on immunity-based products. You know, we've seen that the consumer more than ever, and it dovetails with a lot of the earlier trends we were talking about that underlie Genexa's growth, are turning over the bottle in this case and looking at the ingredient deck and really going two levels deeper than they ever have to understand not just how clean a product is, but also what is the underlying efficacy of that product, and have they done the work to formulate this in a way where I know I'm getting the advertised claims or the benefit statements that are on that bottle. And so that's been an area of focus for us. I'd say when you overlay the channel view to all of that, the other area that we've increasingly focused within our portfolio and certainly on new investments as well is this omni-channel model we were talking about as it relates to Foxtrot. And so, you know, really across different segments, we feel like brands increasingly have to meet the consumer where they are. And that can be across multiple channels. And ideally, they're building that one-to-one relationship and the frequency with which they're interacting because that consumer can access them with convenience in the way that they want.
That is interesting. And your point about these companies really backing up what they're saying, the claims that they're making, that is an interesting point because you have to cut through the noise, right, between what is actually science-backed and research and development-backed versus what is just marketing, really good marketing.
That's spot on. And increasingly, I think the next wave of great brands, you're going to see a lot more white papers and scientific studies that substantiate what they've done on that side. You're going to see human clinical trials. So Olipop right now is undergoing that process, really to just go above and beyond and showing the consumer that they've done the work and you can rely on that and trust them. It's one of the interesting things about Genexa is they have such a sustainable moat against their competition because going through the ANDA, FDA approval process to get a new drug to market can be a two-year process. And especially when you're formulating to clean and stripping out all of these stabilizers, there's real IP there that drives that differentiation and unlock the market for them. And so that is a fundamental tenet that I think you're going to see more and more of the next great brands unlock, which is just, have they really cemented a differentiated process that actually delivers on what the positioning of that product is to the market?
So I have to ask you about valuations. Many consumer and retail companies have commanded really high valuations over the past year. And I'm wondering if that trend is going to continue or if it's going to level off at some point in the near future.
Yeah, it's a great question that obviously is always top of mind for us. I think if you look back at the last 2 years, there's no doubt in my mind that there was a real acceleration of the velocity of transactions, both in terms of new capital raised as well as M&A. And a lot of that was driven by strong underlying market trends. We had a 12-year run of expanded GDP, but also the shift of capital. So you saw a lot of large upstream firms, and in particular, maybe crossover funds, start to come down market and really back the next wave of growth. And where that was even most acute was in this pre-IPO market, because there was a public to private multiple arbitrage. I think if you fast forward to today, those lights that were all blinking deep green, you know, if nothing else, are starting to blink a little yellow. And that encompasses everything from 7.5% inflation to supply chain challenges to labor shortages to now a geopolitical picture that is a little more uncertain and likely interest rate raises on the horizon. And so you combine all of that, and I think you've already started to see the very early transition, certainly in the public markets, where growth stocks have now been re-rated on average around 60% from peaks, but now filtering down market even to where we play, where I think consumers are picking their spots a bit more selectively and coming out of a period where folks were willing to take maybe a 5 to 10 year view on sort of underlying unit economic sustainability and the crossover to break even for high growth brands and opportunities. That view has now shifted to more of a normalized long-term cycle where people say, I want to see a line of sight pathway to profitability. And so all of that, I think you'll see start to ripple through the balance of the year in terms of just more conservative valuations and a flight to quality.
Finally, we've heard so much about Monogram. I'm curious to know if you could distill what differentiates the firm from other consumer-focused investors, what would you hit on?
I think a lot of where we've focused, and I go back to 2014 even, and the conceptualization of firm strategy. And my philosophy was always that capital was going to become more of the commodity part of the equation. And so how do we as a firm, especially one that is founder focused and first institutional capital focused in terms of stage of our partners, come in and really deliver them a playbook and an ecosystem of support? And so from that perspective, you know, we really try and pride ourselves on being very value added and involved in everything from recruiting to operations to top line support and connectivity there to an overall strategic viewpoint as to how to scale and what the right prioritization of initiatives is. I think you've got to complement that in my mind with a self-awareness around where you can add value and where you're better off letting a founder or management team really leverage their own strengths and outperform or overdeliver. And so we try and take that soft touch approach, which is really a line up front on what the core aspects of a blueprint for the investment are going to look like, where a management team spikes and where they could use some supplementation, and how that dovetails with our abilities and our prior experience in each of those spaces, and formulate a joint plan as to how we're going to go to market and really what will define success. And so that's been a core recipe since day one. And it's something that I think hopefully is differentiated in this market.
That's great. Is there anything that I missed out on asking about Monogram or perhaps an interesting consumer trend that you think is worth talking about?
Maybe the last trend I'd highlight, which is just really around the shift toward personalization. So you've had food as medicine, for example. You're now seeing that permeate into beauty and certainly into pet as well. But I think the next iteration of this is truly customized solutions where a consumer can feel like Now the at-home diagnostic testing market is there. There are all sorts of solutions from a Vessel to a Levels to an Aura or Whoop, where you can get a lot of those indicators of your personal health and how they track with different behavioral changes and consumption patterns. And so I do think the next wave of great brands is going to incorporate that into their offering. And you're going to start to see the bar for what consumers hold brands accountable for in terms of personalization really increase and raise over time. So we're keeping close eye on both sides of that equation, which is, you know, how good the data is and what are the critical tools that allow you to get visibility into how your behavior affects you. And then the brands that are actually, again, scientifically delivering against the properties that they're espousing.
Absolutely. Well, Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
This is Nikita Sathyaraju, consumer and retail reporter for The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.